This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, a movie review from Matt Olien, and we have our weekly news discussion with Dave Thompson in a week following a lot of political news. But we are going to start today with a question. Have you ever lied? Okay, I'll refine the question. When was the last time you lied? Whether it's, oh, honey, you look great, or yes, of course there's a Santa Claus. We have all certainly told what is often referred to as white lies. But the implications of lying can be severe, especially when it comes to a professional setting. And so today we are having a conversation about what we expect from others in a professional setting, and specifically when sometimes those people are hired to protect us. We are visiting today with a philosopher, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. It airs the second Sunday of the month at 5 p.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public, and there is a longer version available via your favorite podcast platform. The theme of this month's episode is police and the ethics of lying. Jack, thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here as always.
I want to start with this being a little bit more broad and specific to the rubric that you use for deciding what should be discussed on a show like Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Why this topic?
The guest has been on the show before, and he is a specialist in police ethics. And that in itself interests me. But what I like to do is I like to set up a conversation that isn't always obviously connected to our lives, and then show why, once you start to think about it, it's very specifically connected to our lives. I also like to ask the questions that other people don't get to ask in, let's say, a serious or focused setting. So none of us, or very few of us, are close enough to police officers to say, hey, why do you lie all the time? Or why are you asking me where I'm driving when you pull me over to give me a speeding ticket? Why are you constantly edging me, nudging me to explain myself when I know you're not telling me the truth? And so I think it's a really interesting opportunity to talk about things that are really fascinating, but we don't get the opportunity to really connect with ourselves.
And when you say a term like lying and then use a phrase like all the time, it makes it sound like you think that that is wrong, full stop. And many people would argue you could not have a undercover police officer if not for the act of lying. Am I right in saying you think that lying is wrong at all times?
Truth is the gold standard of ethical behavior. Truth is the thing that we are supposed to be striving for at all times. And then when we veer away from that, we expect to have a justification. The argument isn't that we should tell the truth all the time, or we should never lie. It's that most of us expect us to have a good reason to lie. Just lying for its own sake, or just lying for fun, we tend in our culture to regard that as unethical. So when a police officer stops you and asks where you're going, or do you know why I stopped you, they're not telling the whole truth. They're keeping selective information from you and trying to trap you into saying something that may be as innocuous as, you know, yes, I know I was speeding and I'm sorry, and then you've confessed to a crime, or yeah, I was just coming from my friend's house down in Fargo, and there happened to have been a murder in Fargo 20 minutes ago, and now you're a suspect. right? So they selectively manipulate what they tell you and don't tell you in order to get you to say things that limit your options.
Isn't it also true that they might be selectively saying and withholding information just to judge how you're reacting? If you're shifty-eyed about coming from wherever you're coming from, that can be a telltale sign that you're doing something, you know, wrong.
Police aren't instructed to interview everybody and look to see if they're doing something wrong. Police are expected to have probable cause to stop and interview people in order to confirm whether the thing that they think is happening is actually happening. We don't live in a surveillance society in which we are presumed to be guilty at all times and we are to be interrogated anytime the police want. We live in a society of freedom and individual rights where we are protected from unlawful intrusion. And pulling over someone on the side of the road because you're looking to see if they happen to be doing something wrong is a violation of those rights. And that's why there are very strict rules as to when the police can and can't pull you over, and why every person, regardless of whether they're guilty or not, is perfectly free to say, "I'm sorry, I don't answer questions unless I have a lawyer present."
Is it fair to say, Jack, that the broader theme of the conversation is not so much about when it is okay to lie and not in sort of that the ends justify the means, but more like, is there a metric, a professional ethics by which the officers are being held, like they can measure up to and saying, okay, you lied, but it led to us catching a serial rapist. And so the ends justify the means. And more so your concern is that there is lying that just doesn't outweigh that?
So there's a couple things going on at the same time. There are the professional standards that police officers have to use in order to decide when it is and isn't okay to lie. And you use some examples, right? One is if they're going undercover to do something. Another is if they're interrogating someone and trying to get them to confess. But there are also opportunities when police officers lie about following the rules, or lie when they talk to an innocent person, or lie because it gives them power. Some police officers are wonderful, excellent people. Other police officers don't do their job as well as we expect them to. Part of the process of ethics, part of the process of political philosophy, part of the process of being in a democracy is holding people accountable to the best standards of professionalization and the best standards of what we call best practices, doing what we know is the right thing to do and doing the best we can with the knowledge we have. So I don't think anyone is going to say you should never lie, or a police officer should never lie, ever. Just like most people aren't going to say you should never lie in everyday life, ever. Sometimes we want people to lie to us. But what we are going to say is, especially in a professional circumstance, if you are lying, there has to be a good reason to do it. And part of what our conversation is about is figuring out what those good reasons are.
And where did you land on that?
Well, like all things philosophical, I don't know that I could summarize that in a sentence or two. But the short version is, where we landed is, lying should be rare and it should be justified in circumstances where lying is the only option. And so just trying to manipulate people, just trying to get the truth, that's not justified. So let me put this another way for just a second. One of the things that I say on the show, and one of the things that I've always been bothered by, is the fact that police officers in our culture routinely break the law. They speed all of the time because they know that they're trained drivers, and they will park in illegal parking spots because they know they won't get parking tickets. And I've always felt that police officers should be the most law-abiding people. They should be the gold standard, again, of a citizen who does everything they're supposed to do, because we are trusting them with our lives. And when a police officer testifies on the stand, they have qualified immunity. We believe them. And in a he said, she said situation, the police officer is always going to win. So the conversation is establishing that framework. If we want police to be the best police they can be, when are they allowed to break the ethical rule of always telling the truth? And we're philosophers, so we're allowed to assume that people are their best and that we can fix all broken circumstances and that we can take a profession that is very hard and very complex and boil it down to some very, very clear rules that everyone understands. And that's what we were trying to do.
We're visiting today with philosopher Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. The upcoming episode airs Sunday at 5 o'clock Central, and it's on police and the ethics of lying. And Jack, I listened to the episode, and I thought you came down pretty hard on the side of, generally speaking, you don't really trust cops to be on their best behavior. And in some cases, you cite some personal examples of this. One is, just briefly, is that a fair assessment?
I don't trust police officers to not be doing their job at all time. And what that means is they are constantly looking for clues as to who is guilty. And I don't want to be mistaken for one of those people. Hmm. And so I understand that the consequences of saying something are very, very serious. At the same time, I, like many people, have had some very unpleasant experiences with the police. And that's very difficult because when you have unpleasant experiences, there's no redress. Nobody cares. Mm. I don't have the power. I'm on Prairie Public Radio and I get to say things to the entire state. At the same time, if I file a complaint 9 out of 10 times, nobody's going to care. And I mentioned the Prairie Public thing because that means I have more power than most people. Mm. When a police officer, again, a philosopher's answer here, but we live in a common law society. And what that means is someone can only be punished after they do something. So if a police officer lies about me or entraps me or manipulates me, I have to go to jail or I have to be found guilty before I can fight the situation. Something bad has to happen to me before I get the people who did it wrongly punished. And I don't want to be in that situation. And so in the face of police officers, almost everybody is completely powerless and has to put up with what they're doing, whether they're doing it correctly or incorrectly. And I want, like I think most of us, want to be in a situation where police don't treat me badly.
I want to play a little bit the devil's advocate here, if that's the correct term, because it strikes me that it's got to be a very difficult job, and I don't think that it's something that I could do. And specifically from the sense of, if I'm sort of out there assuming that I'm going to be catching a criminal, I'm going to look at most people as if they're doing something bad, and I would be too afraid of the consequence of getting it wrong, of letting the bad person go as being a more dire consequence than catching maybe the wrong person and hoping that the judicial system will catch up. And part of the conversation, the tone of the conversation anyway, as it struck me as a listener, is that you were really coming down kind of hard on the cops for certain behaviors. But I wonder, why not broaden out the conversation to be more like the conditions that lead to the behavior? And I'll put it like this. Sometimes we look at people who have been abused and we understand that they will become abusive. And given the adrenaline, given the lack of high pay, given the terrible hours and the dire consequences of that job, why not have a conversation that's more like that? Could you look at them as doing the best they can in the face of really challenging situations?
So, first of all, the person I was talking to is a former FBI agent. And so we have the conversation about the experience that he brings to the table. But let me talk about two things that you brought up, which are really very important and philosophically interesting. The first is it better to let a guilty person go free or to punish an innocent person? You expressed concern that by not having these conversations, someone, let's call them a murderer, will go uncaught. Well, what's worse? Someone who's a murderer not going to prison, or the police breaking down the door right now and dragging you away because they decided that you murdered someone 5 minutes ago, even though you were on the radio? Taken just as a whole, in a society in which we presume that people are innocent before they're proven guilty, we generally think it's much worse to punish the innocent than it is to let the guilty go. And so the question we have to ask about the system, about the whole police structure, is it tending towards punishing the right people? And is it set up so innocent people aren't worried about being caught up in a crime? Now, the next thing you set up is super interesting and complex, because you I think, very interestingly connected it to abuse. And you said, all right, well, you know, we know that certain people have been abused and they're more likely to be abusers, so we're going to watch them. How does that work on the day-to-day operations of a police officer walking down the street? Do we say, well, we know that Black people are more likely to be the victims of crimes, so we know that Black people are more likely to commit crimes, therefore we are going to stop Black people instead of white people in order to make sure that they're not committing crimes? They did this in New York for a long time. It was called stop and frisk, where they just pulled Black teenagers over and pulled down their pants on the streets and checked them randomly, depending on your definition of randomly, to see if they had illegal stuff. It was a complete violation of their constitutional rights. So what the police have done instead, because we don't want to, you know, label Black people as potential criminals or 22-year-olds as potential criminals, we start to watch for behavior. We look for those shifty eyes that you mentioned earlier. We look at whether they run for some reasons, but we have to look at it in the context of a crime, and we have to look at it in the context of a particular investigation, because maybe I'm shifty-eyed because I'm really shy, or maybe I'm shifty-eyed because I have a crush on one of the police officers and I don't want them to see me looking at them, or maybe I'm shifty-eyed because I have a horrible headache and I can't look into the sun, so I'm looking down.
Or are from a culture where eye contact is considered either too intimate or too rude.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So there's hundreds of different reasons why someone can be shifty-eyed. To assume that they are potentially guilty of a crime in the absence of a crime that you're investigating is to trap them into a circumstance in which they're more likely to be found guilty of something they didn't do than found innocent of something they did do.
We're visiting today with philosopher Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, the upcoming episode on police and the ethics of lying. But Jack, I want to spend the last few minutes of this conversation broadening this out a little, because most of us will never be police officers and ideally not have to interact with police officers, at least on the negative end of things, too often. But most of us will be professionals. And there are sort of professional codes of conduct. And I wonder how you view an episode like this as something that the rest of us can take some information and use from that perspective.
Sure. So let me just say quickly, we all interact with police officers every day, all the time, on the highway, in stores. We may not know we're interacting with them, but they're there and they're watching us. Now, with that said, I think we can generalize these questions by asking, do we expect our boss to tell the truth to us? Are we expected to tell the truth to our boss? If my boss tells me a lie there has to be a really good reason for it, because otherwise I'm going to do my job wrong. I'm going to be bad at it. I'm going to pursue the wrong things. I'll have the wrong information. At the same time, if I am someone's boss, I want to hear the truth about the business so that I can operate. All of this goes down to the insights of the 18th century philosopher Immanuel Kant, who says, when you lie, you're taking people's freedom away. You're taking away the autonomy. So we tell the truth so people can make the best decisions they can and then be accountable. I'll give you a very quick example. You're at a bar, you're interested in someone, you try to pick them up, and they say, what do you do for a living? And you say, I'm a brain surgeon and I make $10 million a year. And they decide to go home with you. Now, you're not a brain surgeon, you're a Prairie Public person, you make much less than $10 million a year, right? Did they consent?
Did you need to ask that?
did they consent to go home with you? There is this thing that gets called rape through deception, right? Where you tell someone various things and then you know, bad stuff happens without getting into details. When you lie, you take away a person's autonomy and agency. In a free individualistic society like ours, that agency and that autonomy is the most prized thing we have.
Let me broaden this autonomy question out further to something most of us maybe are, and that's parents. And parents lie all the time. And I'm thinking specifically of an example where my former boss, Bill, his daughter said at age 2, I believe, that she didn't want to eat anything on a farm that made a noise, essentially becoming a vegetarian at 2 years old. They let her do that, except when they got a little bit concerned about protein and iron, and they told her that hamburger doesn't make a noise. A cow wouldn't make a noise on a farm, and so she ate some hamburger. Did they take away her autonomy?
Autonomy is something that grows over time. And so we find appropriate spheres for autonomy for a little kid, right? A little kid will say something like, you know, I don't like it when you touch me like that, or I don't like it when you hit me, or something like that. And we respect that. So there are areas that, based on the age, are perfectly appropriate areas to recognize a child's autonomy. And as they get older, that autonomy grows. But the fundamental difference is that the government is not our parent. We want to distinguish between parental care, or what gets called paternalism, where their job is to make decisions for us because we are incapable of making those decisions, and the government, which is not supposed to be paternalistic because we are capable of making our own decisions. That's a huge question. And in communist societies, in authoritarian societies, the government is always seen as paternalistic. It makes decisions for people because it's smarter than people and it knows what's right for people. But in a democracy, individuals are supposed to make decisions for themselves up until that point where their decisions seriously impact someone else. And then the government stops in, not to make the decision for people per se, but to negotiate a conflict in a way that respects everyone's rights.
Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. The episode on the ethics of lying airs this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central. There's a longer version available via your favorite podcast platform. Jack, thanks for your time today.
My pleasure as always.
Still to come on Main Street, our weekly news discussion with Dave Thompson. That's after this.
If you really want to know what's going on in this country ahead of the election next year, you've got to get away from the extremes and listen to the middle.
Hi, my name is Venkat. I'm calling you from Atlanta, Georgia.
On my new live national call-in show, The Middle with Jeremy Hobson, we'll elevate the voices of Americans who need to be part of our national conversation.
Hi, Jan, here in Kansas City, Missouri.
Join me every week for The Middle with Jeremy Hobson.
The Middle. Listen Fridays at 3 p.m. Central, 2 Mountain on Prairie Public.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody.
It's time for our weekly news discussion, and I think there is nobody around who reads more all about it than our very own Dave Thompson. Dave, thanks for joining us today.
You are welcome, Ashley. Glad
all right. Yeah, you didn't have anything going on this weekend, huh?
Not at all.
Couple of conventions.
Good heavens.
Yeah,
and
so
they were interesting conventions, I'll put it that way.
Okay, why do you say that?
Well, number one, the Democrats seem to be a little bit more calm about things. The Republicans, when you get that many people, you start to see some pull and tug and some kerfuffles broke out. And, there were some interesting things that happened on the convention floor.
Any kerfuffles that you are keeping an eye on?
Well, one is how the party is choosing some of its candidates. A lot of the candidates are going to the primary election. And the one kerfuffle had to do with former Representative Rick Becker from Bismarck, who asked his supporters or had his supporters write his name on the ballot. Those were spoiled ballots, so they did not count. So what happened is on the first ballot, none of the candidates got a majority.
Oh my.
And on the second ballot, there were some ballots left blank and they were not counted. And on the second ballot, nobody got the majority. So one of the candidates, Julie Fedorchik, stepped aside for the other guy, this Alex Bezos, who is now the party nominee, but they're going to the primary and that will decide it.
Does this say anything about the structure of the party in general, or was it just, these kinds of things happen?
These kind of things do happen, especially the larger your party is. You see some type of, fractures once in a while, mm-hmm. and you saw that. And I will just tell you that one interesting thing to me, and it's just an observation, that when party conventions happen, you normally have all the delegates on the floor, and they all sit together. Well, given the space limitations of the Sanford Health Athletic Complex, which is basically a basketball arena, very nice basketball arena, mm-hmm. they did not have all the delegates on the floor. They had delegates up in riser sections, so they weren't together on the floor. And a couple of times you saw some empty chairs on the floor, so that the optics looked a little strange, but it had to go because of the way the venue is set up.
Hmm. Yeah, I was surprised to see a headline from you called Drama at the Convention. And I'm like, that is interesting.
That happens, though.
Yeah.
You saw that on occasion when Bill Hygar beat Nick Spaeth in the Democratic Convention back when Hygar was running for governor and Spaeth was running for governor. Hygar won. Spaeth took it to the primary. He won the primary and then eventually lost to Ed Schaefer.
Okay. In the many years that you have been covering conventions, does this one feel any different or is it kind of the same?
It is kind of the same with a couple of different things that have happened. It's just the number of candidates and the number of things that happened are kind of interesting. I just find it very interesting.
I am trying to think here. Is it normal that the Democrats and the Republicans do it on the same weekend?
That's the one thing that was not normal.
Yeah.
Normally, the parties would somehow get together and try to put them on separate weekends so they don't have to share the headlines.
One year
the Democrats would do it first. One year the Republicans would do it first.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time I've seen them together on the same weekend in the same town.
And do we know why?
Not very much. I understand there was no discussion between the two parties.
Is there a little concern if you're saying that they were doing it separately because they didn't want to share headlines? Is the opposite of that possibly true, that they wanted to not get as much news coverage?
Well, that might be possible, but I don't think that's in people's minds necessarily.
Okay. All right. Well, we also have other political news this week. Kara Mund filing for U.S. House.
As a Republican,
mm-hmm.
that will, again, the Republican field is getting a little crowded for that race. And now you have...
Yeah, what are we up to?
I think it's
five.
It's five now,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, okay.
So you've got five people that are seeking that.
Mm-hmm.
And one is an endorsed Republican candidate. One has very good name recognition. Matter of fact, a couple of them do have some very good name recognition in terms of being out there before and, you know, being elected to other offices or actually running a couple of years ago for the congressional seat.
Well, it's interesting, too, that she filed to run as a Republican because, if memory serves me correctly, when she ran a couple of years ago, she filed as an independent.
That is correct, because the Republican was pretty well self-entrenched. And you remember that a few years ago because she was one who was supporting a woman's right to choose. And the Democratic Party had elected somebody or was going to, you know, nominate somebody who was more of a pro-life candidate. And there were certain people in the party who were kind of telling him to step aside and let's support Kara Mund. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit of a tense for a while, let's put it that way, that they did convince the Democrat to step aside, and they said they would put their money behind Kara Mund.
The GOP convention, there was an anti-abortion resolution. Remind us about this here.
Basically, that anti-abortion resolution that they did vote down, by the way, would have basically criminalized any kind of activity concerning an abortion, and that means the woman who got the abortion could be criminally charged with a Class A felony. The Right to Life people in the movement have basically said that was a bridge too far. As a matter of fact, the legislators who supported the current abortion statute in North Dakota said that was a bridge too far. So that was defeated by the delegates.
We also have Governor Burgum here expecting to include more money for fights with the EPA in his executive budget proposal. How many fights are we talking here?
It could be several. There's been fights over clean air, some clean water things. And the state's position is that it really ranks first or second whenever the EPA ranks the cleanest air in the state. And they're saying, no, the EPA now is basically saying, we just want to shut the fossil fuel industry down. So that's where the fights are going to be, is over the fossil fuel industry, over coal, over oil, over natural gas.
And where is this money coming from if it's going into the budget specifically for this?
Well, that's just it. When he puts the budget together, he's got some money, $15 million in some pots that they put together for any particular lawsuits. But if they think that President Biden's going to be reelected, his EPA is bound and determined to shut fossil fuels down. And so he's saying we're probably going to need a lot more than $15 million in the next biennium. Mm. So that's one to watch. I think there is already talk about setting aside money and budgets to do that.
Do you know how this compares in other big oil-producing states like Texas and Alaska?
You know, I don't know for sure. I do think Texas has some permanent funds for they call federal overreach.
And speaking of energy, XL Energy closing its last coal plant. Now, not yet, right?
Not yet, but by the year 2030, they will be out of producing electricity from coal. And they were going to be using renewable sources, their nuclear fleet, and perhaps some natural gas peaking plants, including one that will be constructed in North Dakota.
And what does this mean for the staff that's working there? Have we heard about, you know, job training to allow some people to transition into the different kinds of energy sources?
Xcel's already planning to do that, and they're talking about get them into solar energy, get them into wind power, maybe even some hydro, but also in the natural gas peaking plants, too.
Is it assumed that there will be some job losses, though?
From what I understand, they're going to try to keep them minimal. There might be a few job losses or people who will just decide to take a retirement plan.
And then this one was kind of a surprise. What's going on in the flood diversion?
Now, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
The executive director has turned in his resignation on Tuesday, told the executive committee he would step down. And there was a meeting on Thursday morning. Basically, it appears half the board was not aware of the circumstances that may have led to the resignation. So there's a lot of questions about what's going on there, and this is a personnel matter. A lot of things will probably be kept from the public, but there were a number of board members who are not happy that they didn't know about this until they read it in the newspaper.
Oh, yeah, I can see that being a problem.
Yes, absolutely.
Is it too early to know if this will cause major delays?
I think it's too early at this point to know. I know there's going to be a group that's going to get together, a group subset of the committee, to try to find a new executive director.
Right. Yeah, and what is the kind of typical process for this? I imagine
they'll advertise.
Not a lot of people are qualified for a job like this.
Probably not. The Fargo City Administrator and the Cass County Administrator are going to serve as interim co-executive directors until they find somebody. So that could last for a little while until they find a candidate who is qualified.
Yeah. Do we know, is that typically kind of a national search? Or?
I do not know that for sure yet. I think there's still some discussion about what it will be. I would not doubt that it will be a national search because of the size of that project.
Yeah. And just refresh our memories here. When are they, you know, knock on wood, realizing that construction can be very difficult to actually gauge a timeline for. But, you know, what are they expecting to say, yeah, we're done?
I'm not exactly sure anymore. I thought I heard something about middle part of next year, but maybe that's a lot of things are done, but maybe not all of it's done, but maybe the majority is.
Okay. Yeah, I am looking on their website, and I am seeing one reference to permanent reliable flood protection by 2027, which,
2027.
Again, if my memory serves me correctly, is quite a bit earlier than they originally said.
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
But construction, right. They've had some pretty good years
to
get things built.
All right. We check in with News Director Dave Thompson once a week. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Ashley.
Madeline is next.
Lots of listeners have complimented Ashley Thornburg's interviewing skills over the years, and so have plenty of her guests.
Hi, my name is Bonnie Sommerfeld. I'm from Fargo, North Dakota, originally Valley City, North Dakota. I love all things Main Street. I'm a total fan. And when I come in to be interviewed by Ashley, it's so wonderful. I'm asked questions that are poignant, and I learn things about myself by answering the questions that I did not even know I had or that existed. So I just always look forward to it, and I hope everybody else does too.
If you appreciate thoughtful questions and hosts that take the time to listen, then step up and support Main Street and all the things you enjoy on Prairie Public with a gift of financial support. Just go to prairiepublic.org and open the red link that says donate.
When you hear the fanfare, that means it's time to go off to the movies with our resident movie critic, Matt Olean. Matt, what appears to be a very funny film, Wicked Little Letters.
I think a lot of our Prairie Public listeners and viewers will like this movie because it is set in an English village in about 1920, and it is funny, and it's sort of like not the typical British humor. It's much more vulgar, I would say, because it centers around a real incident that happened in the 20s in England involving some poison pen letters that were being sent around the village. And no one can figure out who is sending the letters. They think they know who has sent them, but, you know, we'll have to see the movie to see what's going on. But I really liked that the director, Thea Sherrick, really he kind of sets it in that kind of 1920s English village, but it also feels like an old Ealing Studios film. So Ealing was a famous British studio, Ashley, that made these kind of light comedies in the late 40s and early 50s, often starring Alec Guinness, and they typically revolve around a small village and some weird goings-on and eccentric characters. So it reminded me a little bit of that, which I liked. And every time I see a film with a lot of Brits in it, I just end up leaving the theater saying, boy, those Brits can really act. They are just so good. It's what they're good at. They produce so many great actresses and actors over there, and they're so good in this movie. Olivia Colman, Jesse Buckley, two big stars, are the leads. recently, a couple years ago, they played the same character in The Lost Daughter. Buckley played the younger version of Coleman. Now they're paired on screen, and their chemistry together as they're kind of battling each other. They're these next-door neighbors that are at odds with each other. Their chemistry is amazing, and they are two of the best actresses in Great Britain, and I really love Jessie Buckley a lot. So they're both very good in this film, and they take the film to another level because of their star performances here.
And what's it about?
It's about poison pen letters. Edith Swan, played by Olivia Colman, is receiving these letters, and they're very vulgar. They're calling her all sorts of names, all sorts of vulgar names. She lives with her parents. Timothy Spall plays her very evil and controlling father. And quickly, the villagers figure out, or the police figure out, that Jessie Buckley is to blame. They think Jessie Buckley is to blame. She lives right next door to Olivia Colman. She plays a single mother living with a man, so there's a lot of people looking down on her for the choices she's making or has to make in her life. And so she quickly becomes the suspect, and then the film goes from there. And it is hilarious in parts. It is really a hoot. There's some great supporting parts.
Is it kind of a whodunit caper?
No. So okay. Within the first 10 minutes, you're going to know who wrote these letters.
Oh, okay.
You're going to know immediately within 10 minutes, but that's okay. It didn't ruin it for me. What's interesting is how the police force, specifically a police officer played by Anjana Vasan, and she is an actress from India, and she plays, this is true, what they call her, Woman Police Officer Moss. That's what they refer to her in the mm-hmm. because it's 1920 and, yeah. there are very few female police officer. Mm-hmm. So it becomes kind of this running joke. Like, you can tell I'm a woman. Just call me Police Officer Moss. But she's kind of on the case trying to figure out who did this. She's hilarious in the part. Another actress, Joanna Scanlon, kind of steals the movie as sort of a villager who has poor hygiene. She even says, I smell awful. I have poor hygiene. But she's funny. And she's kind of out to figure out who sent these letters. So it goes back and forth like that. It's very funny in parts. Like I said, it's not a whodunit. I don't think it's going to win a lot of awards, anything like that. But I do think maybe this is the kind of entertainment people are looking for right now. Mm. And when I saw it at the Fargo Theater, it was packed and people were laughing. I would call it a hoot. We see who did it. We know who does it very quickly on. But you need to go see it because, again, the Brits can act and there's so many good performances. And I think it's even kind of a female empowerment movie, Ashley. Once the film wraps up, you kind of realize on a couple different levels, both with Olivia Colman's character and her relationship to her father, and also just, woman police officer Moss. Mm-hmm, it becomes kind of this very subtle woman empowerment movie, but it doesn't really bang you over the head with that message. It's just at the end I realized, hey, that's really what's going on here. It's also another mixed race movie. We're starting to see more of this in the last few years, the personal history of David Copperfield a couple years ago with Dev Patel as David Copperfield. And at first, when they started doing this, it was kind of jarring, but I am used to it now and completely okay with it. So, the police officer Moss, the actress playing her, is from India. There probably would have been no way a female from India living in Great Britain would have been able to be a police officer in 1920. But we're okay with it. It's fine. And so I think we're getting these mixed race movies now with Old England, and I kind of like it, actually, even though, it probably wouldn't have been possible for a woman of color to be a police officer in England in the 20s. She does kind of steal the movie, and she's really hilarious in the part. So I'm okay with this kind of newfangled casting that we're getting in historical dramas.
Well, and it speaks a little bit more to the role that movies play in diversity now, and just seeing more people on the screen. You saw a very different film also this weekend, and that this is some sort of special re-release of The Godfather?
Yeah, and it was a 4K restoration. I have never seen Godfather in the theater, only on television.
Uh-huh.
And so this is probably my 10th time seeing it. I didn't move once. It's still amazing. Make sure you go to the bathroom before it starts. But I went with some friends, including a friend who'd never seen it, and she loved it. And what I noticed with the 4K, Ashley, was the moments of violence, when they come, the gunshots are louder, much louder than if you're watching on television. It was like hitting you with audible, You know, when Michael kills the policeman and Salazzo in the Italian restaurant, I mean, the gunshots are loud on screen. So it looked great on the big screen, and the sound was really amazing. Hmm. That's what I noticed.
Is this some kind of trend happening in movies right now, too?
Yes. So Gone with the Wind was playing the same day in a different theater. Blazing Saddles is coming in September, and Wizard of Oz. So they are... this is a trend now to re-release movies, and there was at least 30 people watching The Godfather, and looked like some younger people that maybe they were seeing it for the first time. Okay. So I like this trend.
So enhancing sound, are there changes in, you know, sort of Technicolor presentations and what have you,
It still looks very much the same. Okay. It's just you're seeing it on a wide, big screen, and if you like that, which I do, it is worthwhile going to. I'd love if they'd re-release Godfather 2 this year, because it is the 50th anniversary of Godfather 2, which came out in 74, Godfather 1 coming out 2 years prior in 1972.
I know the answer to this, but do you want them to re-release Godfather 3?
No.
I couldn't.
We'll just put that in the vault, and Coppola can re-edit that sucker all he wants. It's not going to make it any better. Good question.
All right, Matt, going for Oscar trivia now, going back to Wicked Little Letters, Jessie Buckley in the film, an Irish actress.
She is.
And so inspired a little bit by Ireland and the strength of Irish performers over the years, including one person who is the only person to be nominated in two acting categories for the same role in the same movie in the same year.
Barry Fitzgerald, Going My Way, 1944. As Irish as they come, he was on screen, Barry was.
Yeah, they had to change the rules about nominations after that film. All right, we've been to the movies with Matt Olean.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 6 is about Native contributions. It states, Native people continue to contribute to all levels of society, from local to global, in diverse fields including medicine, science, government, education, economics, art, music, and many more. In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to Dr. Twyla Baker, enrolled member of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation, in part two of To Us, It Wasn't Discovered.
You know, there was stories and history and life and cities and just everything that was all here already, you know, didn't just suddenly appear out of nowhere. So, there's that, but then there's also in the modern context, I think of like my friend John Harrington, who was the first Native American astronaut. I was just looking at his pictures of him doing work outside the space shuttle and things like that. People like that making contributions to the academic realm, to sports, to art, life in general, just like any other individual. We just happen to be such a small population, so our impact may not be as loud as others, but we're still here. We are still here. There was a concerted effort to remove us, but it makes me so proud. It feels so strong, the idea and the fact that we are still here. We are still thriving. We are working very, very hard to make our voices heard. We are just living our lives, and doing so in the way that we want to. Reclaiming that sovereignty and trying to make things better and the path clearer and wider for the ones that come behind us.
I'm Sharla Stever. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org. Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.